I'm a faithful servant to Lucifer.
I've been blackening souls for longer than I can remember.
So now we're going to talk about Winter's Tale, which it was based on a book that, as I understand, I don't think any of us have read it.
No.
But it's apparently a very dense book full of lots of stories and emotions and theories and things. And I've heard the book is amazing. So Akiva Goldsman read this book and was like, I'm going to make a movie, and took apparently a little part of the book and decided to make a movie. And the movie he made is indecipherable. It's so bad. I'm so excited to talk about it. But I'm going to read you the IMDb plotline because it doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. The three of us have seen this movie, and I feel like we all agree that we're like, who wrote this plotline? Like, okay, so the plotline, according to IMDb, is a burglar falls for an heiress as she dies in his arms. When he learns that he has the gift of reincarnation, he sets out to save her.
There's no reincarnation in this movie.
Yeah, I was about
no!
to say, there was reincarnation. There's
and, like,
a magical flying horse. There's no reincarnation that I...
There is. Yeah, there's angels and demons.
Mm-hmm.
There's magic crystals, maybe? I don't know if the crystals were magic. I don't...
Oh, like the
pebbles.
Things that look like bath were they... that are like...
Yeah, the pebbles that, like,
yeah.
Russell Crowe, like, fucks
yeah.
with.
That, like, Russell Crowe plays a demon slash crime boss, and he has crystals that when he puts in light, they project, like, 3D models of places, so he knows where people are. I don't... What? Like, are there... Oh, God. So I saw this movie with Perry next to me, which was amazing, and I wish I had videotaped your responses, because, like, I know at one point I turned to you and you were just like this. It wasn't because the movie is scary.
There's a pretty solid, like, minute where... Like, tears were, like, gushing from my eye. I know when it was. You know when, like, Russell Crowe has this little fit and he gets some blood on his hand and he's, like, slaps
no.
my... He, like,
I think we can, I think we can say what happens because it's been all over Twitter. Russell Crowe rips off a man's face and then uses the blood to draw a picture. And then he hands this picture, which is nonsense. It's just the back of someone's head. Like, literally, it is a... Whatever.
I just want to say that the words draw... The words draw and picture are, you're being very forgiving here. He basically just, like, takes his blood, like, splats some of it on like, a tablecloth or a napkin
yeah.
or something.
And then he's like,
just a
find this girl. And my, okay, so I'm sorry. I'm going to backpedal a little bit. Colin Farrell plays a thief in 1916 New York. He is trying to break ties with crime boss Russell Crowe, who is also a demon. Whether or not Colin Farrell's character knows if Russell Crowe's character is a demon, no idea, because the movie can't seem to decide. Sometimes he
but
doesn't
you know,
seem aware.
I feel like he wouldn't be fazed, because also when a magical horse shows up, he's
well,
just like,
yeah,
saying. That seems about right.
Well, he says, like, the horse can jump really high. I'm like, that wasn't jumping. You clearly flew. Like, what? Okay, so anyway, he meets this girl. He's breaking into a house, and he meets this beautiful redheaded girl played by the girl from Downton Abbey, and she's beautiful and breathy, and I love her, and she's whatever. So he meets her, and, like, they have, like, that, like, hey, we're gonna get together moment, and their meet-cute is him breaking into her home, and for some reason, Russell Crowe is threatened by this, I don't know, and then he goes to talk to... Satan, I don't know, whatever, I don't know. He doesn't want them to be together for reasons that I'm unclear on. Something about miracles, I don't know. And so, yeah, he's like, I know what she looks like. Face rip, blood doodle, and then he hands, like, this piece of tablecloth to his assistant and is like, find her. But my favorite part of the movie, because that was the only, that, like, Perry can vouch for this, I did that, like, hard piercing, what are you talking about type laugh. In a theater full of people that was just dead silent, someone's, like, helping her get into a cab, and then he, like, looks at her, and she turns around, and then he pulls up a sheet of paper that is basically a Xerox of the drawing, which doesn't make any sense. It's 1916. But he looks at it, and it looks at her as if to be like, that's definitely her. And I just laughed so hard.
The plot hinges on, like, the fact that nobody in this movie has ever met more than one redheaded person
yes!
in their entire life. Like,
yeah, being redheaded, like, is treated like you are the Holy Grail in this movie. Like, oh,
yeah,
she's
it's
right
like,
there. It must be her. Obviously.
My favorite part is when, because, you know, so Colin Farrell is romancing Lady Sybil from Downton Abbey, and so then he, like, meets her family, and he's like, having a heart-to-heart with her dad, where the dad is like, you know, what are your intentions, blah, 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 and they're chatting.
And they discuss wallets and fillets.
They discuss, like, when the tea is silent. They spend, like, a good 5 minutes being like, is it claret or claret? Is it fillet or fillet? You don't call it a wale. And that's, like, a whole, like, chunk of the movie that I don't know why.
But then toward the end, just like,
toward the end of the conversation, Colin Farrell is like, do you think it's possible to love someone so much that they can never die? And the dad's like, no.
Yeah. That says to a widower. It's such a shitty thing to say to a widower. Because the implication
that's
is,
the funniest thing
you did.
I've ever seen. I don't even know. The dad just sounds so like, this is a man who's talking about, you know, like, I love your daughter so much that I literally think I can prevent her from dying. And not only is he like, oh, that's
because she has,
like,
consumption. I might have, like, forgotten that.
Yes.
She has consumption.
He
so
has,
she's
like, the dad
always
has
wearing summer dresses.
The dad has
and
no reaction
sleeping
to this.
On a roof in a tent, which every time I saw that, I had to laugh, even though there was a reason for it.
Yes. The dad's reaction to, like, the way the dad says no to that question is, it, like, if Colin Farrell was like, oh, are we having steak for dinner? Like, no.
You want to see some of my favorite parts of the movie?
Yes.
Can you see it? Am I holding it clear enough?
You're holding it, but we can't read it.
Well, this is all of, like, the nonsense that I scribbled down. If you'd like to hear some of them. Oh, here's my favorite line from the movie. This is a Jennifer Connelly gem. Where she
casually says,
did we explain what happens after?
I feel like that might be spoilers, but eventually they jump to the future. I think we can say that. Eventually it jumps to modern times and he meets Jennifer Connelly and because I guess reincarnation?
No,
he magically ends up in 2014 and he has no memory of who he is, but he's just like hanging out there, and then he meets Jennifer Connelly and he's like, can you help me try to find out who I am? And that's the second half of the movie.
And then she courts him by saying, I live down on 12th Street and I've got chicken. And
I've got chicken
later on too.
Yes, he shows up, he's like, I like chicken.
Yeah, and then he's like, you're the only family with this last name on 12th Street. I'm like, what?
Yeah, it implies that he spent the entire evening going,
like,
from every building, looking at every single buzzer, looking for someone
because
with this last name.
Because we know everybody updates those. Those are always really accurate and up to snuff.
Yes, and 12th Street is tiny. You know, it's not, by no means is it a long street that crosses all of Manhattan.
I actually have, here, like, my notes read, what? Question mark? The fucking redheaded girl sketch. Hot boiler fixing action, because that's a scene that happens. Headbutt fighting. Like, mm-hmm. I don't.
Oh, I have headbutt fighting.
Yeah, there were so many moments where I was literally looking to other people in the audience because I felt like a crazy person. Like, I felt like I had missed 20 minutes somewhere because the movie made so little sense. Like, it's extraordinary. And, like, and Perry pointed out, and I'll let you expand on this point, but, like, Perry pointed out that it's not just that the story doesn't make any sense. Like, the way it is shot is atrocious.
There's a pretty good chunk of this movie where people are talking, and you're literally looking at the back of their heads. And, like, this is Akiva Goldsman's first time directing a movie. Maybe that's part of it. But, like, that's, like, a nonsensical shot. Any person in this world would naturally feel inclined to need to see someone's face when they're saying certain lines of dialogue, and he gives us no access for things like that.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel like an artistic choice. I explained it to my husband, like, this feels like a movie of someone who's never seen a movie made, but was like, like if you said to an alien, let me explain to you what a movie is, and then the movie were like, make one. Like, that's what this feels like. It is so completely ignorant of, like, film storytelling. Like, it does not tell you stories with pictures, and, like, a big part of the problem for me, which I focused on in my Cinema Blend review, is that this magical realism that Goldsman keeps talking about in the press, he doesn't establish it early enough. So it feels like we're constantly playing catch-up. Like, you know, my example is Star Wars. It starts off with, here is a spaceship flying through space. Here is the reality in which I am presenting you. So your suspension of disbelief is on the same page with what is demanded of you from the filmmaker. This movie just starts off with some long-winded talk about maybe stars or people, and, like, this, I mean, that's the thing. And then it goes back and forth between, like, this story of these people at Ellis Island that doesn't make any sense to us until, I'm going to say, about an hour and a half into the movie. Maybe less, whatever, I don't know, the movie doesn't make sense, but these two people who are credited as young men and young women, so good luck with that, and then him in the modern day, but it's, like, unclear, it's this really confusing hodgepodge back and forth. Like, it needs to start with the horse flying around Manhattan so that we're like, oh, this is a movie where Pegasuses exist, where angels are a thing. Because otherwise it starts off and it's just like your typical like New York, the turn of the century crime movie where it's like, here's a guy running away from thugs. Why is there a shiny white horse here? Oh, well, jump on. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And then, like, they take off effectively flying, though he thinks he's jumping, whatever.
It's like the opposite of Vampire Academy. That goes out of its way to explain everything so it makes sense, and this just has none of that. Like,
yeah.
Everything is just, they expect
it takes for granted that we're on board.
Yeah, and, like, yeah, I forgot to mention the part where they plop a baby in a boat and go push and expect it to float right to Manhattan.
No, you're saying boat, but it's like a model ship. Like, it's like one of those boats that's like 3 foot long, and they're like, because the idea is that his parents, Peter Lake's parents, were rejected for heart conditions, and so they're like, but can't we leave our baby here in America? And like, the Ellis Island guy's like, ain't nobody got time for this. So they're like, they steal a display boat that's, I guess, at Ellis Island, and they take it back onto the boat that's going back to Ireland, and then they lower the baby down, and it caused giggles in our audience, because you're just like, well, that baby's gonna die. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And they just, like, let it drift, I guess, to New York. Okay. But, I mean, like, that's the thing. Like, if they had established this is a world where magic is real, where, like, you know, angels and everything are real, then that would be fine. But that's, like, the first kind of magic realism image you're given. And my first thought was just, well, that's preposterous. And what makes me angry is that in the press conference that Perry and I both attended, and we will both have coverage up on this that we can put in links, if people are interested, they can read about it. But Akiva Goldsman said that to him, the film is about rejecting cynicism. And I hate that that's his point on it, because I don't consider myself a cynical person at all. I, you know, and this movie makes me feel cynical because it makes me be like, ugh, please. But that's because the movie's failing. That's not on me. That's his failure as a director to get me on board. I want to see a movie that believes in love. I want to see a movie where miracles are real, because that's wonderful. But that's not what this movie's, like, this movie fails to get me there. And I don't like that his insistence that it's about not being cynical implies that everyone who doesn't like it is cynical. What do you guys think about that?
I get the sense that what happened with him with this is he lived in it for so long and obsessed over it for so long that he just wasn't able to pull back and view it as a movie. Like, he just lived in this thing for so many years, and it wasn't just a movie to him. It became really important because of some tragedy in his own life, and I think that just distorted his perspective, and he can't relate to how anybody else would feel about this movie, and that just makes me absolutely baffled by how he could get so many people on board to take part in this. I understand that he is a prolific writer and producer and probably has a lot of favors that he can call for, but someone in that, like, freaking Colin Farrell, Jennifer Connelly, Russell Crowe, Will Smith, someone had to say, that's not right. Like, stop doing that. Change that. Don't waste the money Warner Brothers gave you on that. What is wrong with you? At some point. Yeah.
Somebody had to have read the script and go, okay, I mean, why? Like, cause it's just, there, you know, and one thing, and I said in my review, the only credit I can give this movie is it is trying really hard. No one in this movie showed up and just took a paycheck. Like, they are all really working to make this movie, you know, something. But, like, it's a failure of the director and the writer, because he did both. Like, he fails. Like, I put in my review that, like, this movie fails on so many levels, I don't like calling it a movie. Like, I hesitate to call it a movie.
Can we talk about
spoilers?
Yes. Can we talk about spoilers?
Wrap up. Yeah. Spoilers. This is your one and only spoiler alert. We are going to talk about spoilers for Winter's Tale. If you do not want to hear them, turn this off now, and we'll see you next week. Spoiler time. Let's do it. I want to talk about Will Smith.
Oh, fuck! Will Smith was the best part of this movie.
But who thought that that was a good idea? He was the best part about this movie because this movie was just one big joke. Like, if this movie had been what it should have been and they plopped Will Smith down in there, like,
it is distracting.
The reason Will Smith is good in this is because, one, because he should play more characters like this, but two, because the role is absolutely ridiculous. This is freaking Lucifer, the devil with sparkly hoop earrings and a Jimi Hendrix t-shirt.
And a blazer.
Why? Why?
What else should the devil be wearing?
I don't know. I actually really like
that. Maybe that's a good point.
That was actually, like, I like that because, like, while everybody else is, like, acting the whole movie. Like, it's real hard, like, ooh, you know, like, Colin Farrell is adorable. And so, like, cheers to him. Like, I'm not saying people are bad in this, but, like, Russell Crowe is doing, like, full-on acty face where he's like, oh, I hate Peter Lake, picture. Like, you know, it's a whole thing. But, like, Will Smith is actually really good in this. Like, it's actually, like, cause I feel like Will Smith has become this kind of facet where he's just, like, I'm charismatic. And he doesn't really have to act in movies. But in this, he actually gives a performance that is interesting, but it doesn't make any damn sense just because, I don't know, like, the devil doesn't really have an important part to play in the thing. I don't understand why he seems to live in the docks.
The other thing I don't understand is why the devil's powers only apparently extend to the five boroughs of Manhattan, because they're always like, oh, we need to go above Manhattan. And I was like, you mean the clouds? And they're like, no, we mean upstate, because we're safe as long as we're in upstate New York.
Yeah.
And I was like,
Manhattan
and there's
all that matters.
And if you would think, like, you know, if the devil had any jurisdiction at all in upstate, he would send one of his other agents there, even if Russell Crowe couldn't get there. But no, he's just, they're all just like, bummer, he went to Yonkers, so, you know, now we can't do anything.
He's like, out of our jurisdiction.
I was like, you guys can't take the fucking, like, Metro North? Like, it's not that hard to get there.
No, they have to drive their big, expensive cars all the way
out there
just so they can see
on
the
ice lake.
And fall through.
Yes, they drive over an ice lake. The other thing is that, so in the end, you find out that basically what happened was...
The end is insulting.
Beverly, so apparently every human gets a miracle that they can perform. And Beverly's is that she gets Colin Farrell to love her so much that he is incapable of dying. Right? And then his is that, and so that's miracle number one. And then we find out that, like, his whole miracle is that he can save this dying kid from cancer that he met, like, 5 minutes ago. And it's just like, that seems like a really convoluted way for the side of good to solve what seems like it should be, why don't you just make the kid's miracle that she gets over cancer? I don't know. It was just like, and it was also just like, oh, so we spent all of this story was leading up to it saving a little girl that we have seen.
Maybe 10 minutes of
screen
time.
For like 10
minutes.
That
she's unconscious.
The movie says the biggest problem, like, it actually states the issue with that
whole
thing.
Very laughed out loud at this point in the voiceover.
Now I can't read my notes. Why would so many things conspire to save one girl's life? And I think during that screening, I audibly said, "Great question!" And like,
no, you did. You were it just exploded out of you.
After like a 2-hour movie, you're gonna say that, and you know what? That's a great question because it's a question you never answer, and that is why this movie is just so moronic.
Exactly. That's your thesis statement. You need to figure that shit out before you shoot. Like, it just, it's so frustrating, this movie. Like,
it's frustrating, but I'm having an absolute blast tearing this apart. I probably will say this is going to be on my worst of the year list, but normally my worst of the year list is populated with movies that are so bad that they make me mad. This is kind of like, it's so bad that I'm having fun with it.
That's certainly true. I did enjoy watching the movie because it's just such a train wreck. But, like, I feel like that's what people like to think critics feel like, that we like ripping movies apart, and I don't. I would much prefer to have just been on board with this movie. I would much prefer to just be, like, watching The Cutting Edge and crying my heart out. But, like, this movie... I think I'm probably the only one that referenced The Cutting Edge in a review of this anyway. But, like... Winter's Tale is just so stupendously bad that, like, it is fun to watch with a group of people and just be like, what is happening? I keep telling other critics that were like, we begged Angie to go see it so we could talk about it. And then I was telling other critics, they're like, I heard it's bad. Why would I go see it? And I was like, because people are going to keep talking about how bad this movie is. Like, that bad.
I walked out of the movie and I was just like, I have about 400 questions. And they're just, some of them are really small, like, what the fuck is up with his haircut that kind of just comes and goes?
That's my favorite note. I literally wrote, where is it? It says, what with that fucking hair? With, like, multiple question marks following it. His hair grows out, and then he's got to go and cut that same damn haircut back.
Yeah,
it drove me off my mind.
And that's how we know that he remembers he's Peter Lake, because acting can't do that, I guess.
And then what? Why does a major New York City newspaper have a 107-year-old editor?
Yes.
That
I don't
was
know
another
why it's set
question.
In the modern day. They could have made it set in like the 80s and 90s and it would have been fine.
It was published in the 80s, and if you think about it, it's like, okay, you know, like,
that's
had she been
less
like
ridiculous.
70s,
they also
80s
said that during the press conference, like, it was just like, oh, yeah, she's like over 100.
Oh, yeah, because, like, the New York Times would never would fire someone for being 102. That would never happen. What? Like, That's insane. It's insane. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like Eva Marie Saint in this, and she was the best part of the press conference because she is crushing on Colin Farrell so bad.
But, like, for real, though, it wasn't, yeah, like, a she's joke. Amazing. Like, she referenced that sex scene, like, four times.
Yeah, she was like, I wish I were Jessica Biel. Like, she didn't care. I love it because she's at that point where she's like, screw it. I'm the old lady. I can say whatever I want. I love her. Someone else called her Eva, and she's like, it's Eva Marie. Yeah.
That sex scene was absurd.
She said all that stuff, and I thought the sex scene sucked.
I thought the sex scene was sweet, but there's weird close-ups of his back. Like, not his backside.
That's a perfect example of the problem with the shot selection. Yeah. That's a scene where you need access to people's face and not the back.
Yeah, I don't need to see, like, nudity. Just give me some skin that's, like, you know, can like, suggest sex. Like, just his naked back is not...
It never actually looked like they were having sex. It looked like they were just laying in bed, like, panting heavily. And that was, like, and then giggling. And that was, like, what they think sex looks like. Which, to be fair, this is a world where white-winged horses appear out of nowhere and people just accept it.
Maybe people don't pump in this world.
I don't know.
But actually, I'm going to bring this up really quickly. That actually reminds me, in Endless Love, another remake that comes out tomorrow, or this week, there's a sex scene in there that is clearly supposed to be PG-13, so I laughed really hard. I've been acting it out with people to make them uncomfortable. I basically stand really close to someone and then just stare at them, because that is what that scene looks like, except that it's horizontal. Like, they're basically just on top of each other, but because of PG-13, they can't move.
I felt like the Winter's Tale one was kind of like that.
Yeah, it's just like...
You know, people, like, move during sex. It's not like they just kind of, like, lay there for 10 minutes, and they're like, well, that's over.
Right? Like, I watched this, and I'm like, I'm doing sex wrong, I guess. I guess it's just like, so hi. I did it to, I did that, I stood right in front of Jenny Miller, and then I said, now just imagine that I'm inside you, which was weird, and I probably shouldn't have. She felt uncomfortable. But, like, yeah, it's just, it's that really awkward where, like, we know what sex looks like, so you don't have to get, like, super graphic with it, but, like, motion helps. Even just a close-up of a mouth and a gasp or something, but, like, you know, Winter's Tale and Endless Love both have these really dull sex scenes, and it's just, like, what's the point? If you're gonna give me, like, a really bland sex scene, can we just show the sun coming up or something? I don't care.
Can they just do what they did in, like, Star Wars Episode 2, where they just, like, see them staring intensely at each other, and then it just pans to the fireplace?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That was fun.
Subtle.
Sexy. All right, on that note, we are way over, so any last words before we leave Winter's Tale behind?
I think if you enjoy seeing movies that are bad, you should see Winter's Tale.
I don't think it's worth seeing, even if you enjoy...
Maybe not in theaters. I don't necessarily know that it's worth that, but make it a point to watch this with some friends.
Watch it with other people. It's no fun if you're watching it by yourself.
I'd agree. Communal experience with a whole bunch of alcohol, and you can have a lot of fun with this thing.
Agreed. Yeah.
Have it some Prosecco.
I've come to believe that a human is on the verge of saving the red-haired girl.